From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The approaching 20th anniversary of Woodstock may evoke memories of 3 days of peace and music, but for the festival's two backers, the memories are of crises and near disasters. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Joel Rosenman and John Roberts about financing and co-creating the Woodstock Festival. Also today, we meet the alter ego of that hyperkinetic pitchman Mo Moskowitz. He's satirist and author Robert Kaplow. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new reggae albums, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the Tom Hanks movie Turner and Hooch. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Officials said today that U.S. diplomats suspected of spying for the Soviets received merit raises totaling more than $13,000 for work described as well above average. Unidentified officials say Felix Bloch got three merit raises of $4,000 or more in 3 years. Government sources have said Bloch was videotaped in Paris handing a briefcase to a Soviet agent. He's not been charged with a crime, but his diplomatic passport and State Department credentials have been revoked. Bloch is under surveillance in a New York City suburb. In Lebanon, Virginia, a circuit judge has levied another multi-million-dollar fine against the United Mine Workers for what he calls acts of terror in the coal fields. More from Chris Roberts of member station WVTF.
Russell County Judge Donald McLaughlin, who in May fined the union almost $3 million for its civil disobedience tactics in front of Pittston facilities, today levied more fines, totaling nearly $4.5 million. McLaughlin charged the union with creating a feeling of terror throughout Southwest Virginia, and he scolded those miners and union officials who have been assaulting and threatening people during the nearly four-month strike against Pittston. He said the dispute has resulted in a tremendous outpouring of public money into the region to protect citizens from union violence and a loss of local tax revenues. Many of McLaughlin's fines stemmed from his finding that the union failed to stop its members from participating in the moving blockades that have slowed Pittston coal traffic. Union attorneys said they expect to appeal the judge's ruling. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Roberts in Roanoke.
The Cambodian peace talks in Paris overcame a major stumbling block today, Kathleen Hunt reports.
A spokesman for the French Foreign Ministry, which is sponsoring the peace conference on Cambodia, said the seating dispute was resolved at a meeting this afternoon between staff members of the three resistance factions and the Vietnamese-backed government in Phnom Penh. They agreed that the Cambodians would be represented by one single delegation, seated under that name. But within it, the leaders of each of the four factions will be identified by his own name. The seating plan is apparently a concession for Prime Minister Hun Sen, who's been insisting on two separate delegations, one for his pro-Vietnamese government and one for Prince Sihanouk's coalition. But the compromise clears the way for the International Peace Conference to begin. And with U.S. Secretary of State James Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze taking part, the conference is viewed as the first major attempt to find a political settlement to Cambodia's 10-year conflict. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Paris.
A career criminal has been convicted of murdering Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme in 1986. Christer Pettersson was found guilty today and sentenced to life in prison. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 29.97 points. This is NPR News. The Commerce Department says the nation's economy grew at an annual rate of 1.7% during the second quarter of this year. It was the slowest growth rate in nearly 3 years. NPR's John Itzde has more.
This report of slow growth is generally seen as positive by economists and policymakers. That's because the economy was growing so fast last year that inflation pressures were building. And for some economists, this slowdown in the second quarter fits the soft landing scenario that the Federal Reserve Board has been trying to engineer. The Fed tried to gently slow the economy last year by pressuring up interest rates to choke off growth, but recently reversed its policy to try to keep the economy from falling into a recession. Other economists say today's report suggests the nation will flirt with a recession during the next year. For most Americans, the difference between recession and very slow growth would be barely noticeable. But unemployment, the most drastic effect of slower growth, would likely be experienced by more people if a recession occurs. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
The House Judiciary Committee has approved a Democratic-backed measure outlawing desecration of the American flag. The measure drew criticism from the White House and congressional Republicans, who say the bill is not strong enough. The bill now goes to the full House, where passage is expected next week. President Bush believes a constitutional amendment is the only way to protect the flag. The Elks voted today to remain an all-male organization. The Elks boast a nationwide membership of roughly 1.5 million members, but membership has been declining, and those who wanted to admit women said that might have remedied the problem. The members did approve a proposal that could make it easier for non-white men to join the fraternal order. The Elks eliminated the blackball rule, which allowed any three members of the Elks Lodge to reject a prospective member. Some said the rule made it difficult for blacks to join the organization. And a new opinion poll says West German Chancellor Hull isn't doing very well. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. August 15th through 17th marks the 20th anniversary of the Woodstock Festival. For two of the festival's originators, it took years before they could think of it as anything but the Woodstock Crisis, a crisis that ended with acres of mud, garbage, more than 70 lawsuits, and a huge debt. My guests Joel Rosenman and John Roberts financed the festival with their fledgling venture capital company. Their initial capital was from an inheritance Roberts came into at the age of 21. Rosenman and Roberts are still partners in their venture capital company. In 1974, they collaborated on a book about their Woodstock calamities called Young Men with Unlimited Capital. It's just been republished by Bantam. Their Woodstock story starts back when they were roommates in New York. Roberts was working on Wall Street. Rosenman was a lawyer who also had a club act. Neither of them liked their work. They were trying to think of alternatives when they came up with an idea for a TV sitcom.
It was about two young guys with a little bit more money, perhaps, than common sense, who were keen on getting into business deals. They had no idea about business. They were susceptible to making colossal and, we hoped, hilarious mistakes. And every week they would be extricated from one predicament or another by some miracle. We wrote up what's called in the business a treatment. It described the premise of the show. It got the characters pretty well delineated, and we took it to TV professionals who loved it. Unfortunately, we hadn't included any plot ideas because we didn't have the faintest idea about what business scrapes they might get into. And so in an effort to scare up some plot material, we took out a classified ad in the Wall Street Journal and in the New York Times describing, we hoped, these characters. Two young men with unlimited capital seek interesting and legitimate business propositions. Please write box number, and so forth. Well, every con artist, criminal, crook, sharpie, and lunatic in creation put pen to paper, and thousands of responses poured in. Power sources from the eighth dimension, edible golf balls, weird singing woodchucks on tour in Canada. And sooner or later, Jock and I had amassed a number of these, what we called nut responses, for our TV show. And then one of those odd things happened in life. a response came in that interested us, in our naive way, in the business venture itself. Months later, we had jumped into our TV sitcom, become the characters, and found ourselves in a lunatic business venture called Woodstock.
Well, The people whose proposition you actually liked were two guys who had been in the record and concert promotion industry, and they had proposed setting up a studio in Woodstock near where Bob Dylan and the band were living. And then you all figured, well, why not do a concert, a benefit concert, to raise the money to fund the studio? And that's the concert that became Woodstock. What was the initial idea here? What did you envision the concert as being like?
Our first go-round, we hoped to get about 25,000 people. That was in, say, March of 1969. By mid-April, we realized we might actually attract 35 to 50,000. By, say, early June, we were looking at 75,000. By late July, we thought improbably enough that we were going to have 100,000. And by the day before the concert, we had everybody in America.
Was there a point where you realized this was not going to be about creating a studio in Woodstock? This was going to be just about this concert?
Yes, there was a point. In fact, it got increasingly obvious. so that even we eventually could see that we were not going to be making A, profits, B, we were going to be making probably history. And I think for sure, days and days before the start of the event, when already more people were sitting in the performance area as our audience than we had expected as a sellout crowd months before. They were there early just to get a good seat. We knew we were in trouble. And surely, when the event began and traffic backed down to Florida, it seemed to us, and people seemed to be coming in great huge tides and with no end, we knew that A, we were going to see no profits, and B, recording studio was just a fond dream.
My guests are John Roberts and Joel Rosenman, and they're the two who put on and who backed the Woodstock Festival 20 years ago, and they have a book about that experience that's just been reissued called Young Men with Unlimited Capital. Were you both in on booking the acts?
Yeah, booking the acts was done by professionals. We all were in on selecting the acts, and by all, I mean not just the four original concert promoters, but our girlfriends and friends and anybody we danced with at any time. We were open to ideas. We knew it was going to take a tremendous amount of talent to fill up all those hours, and that was even before we had extended the performance times when we saw how many people had arrived.
There's a lot of interesting behind-the-scenes stories in your book. One of them that interested me was this blackmail call that you got from a member of the New York Underground. And it turned out, I think, to be Abbie Hoffman?
It was Abbie Hoffman. Of course, we have a fairly unique and different perspective about Woodstock, having been, as it were, in the boiler room constructing and running this particular operation. And most people don't know about that story, and it's in the book. But the Underground had hoped that, the Radical Underground, I should say, had hoped that Woodstock would be a forum for their political ideas, that we would give them time on stage, that we would allow them to have booths, distribute leaflets, and so on. And it had been our very firm intention to keep this as non-political as possible. This was 3 days of peace and music. Abbie Hoffman summoned us down to his headquarters down in Greenwich Village in New York, and announced that if we did not come across with some money and some stage time and booths and so on, that he was going to make our life a misery. Nothing he could do could have made our lives more miserable than they were by that July. We'd already been kicked out of our first site. So we said, essentially, do your worst.
Which was what?
Well, his worst turned out to be he jumped up on stage during the Who's performance and was booted off unceremoniously by Roger Daltrey. Later on, I think he did manage to distribute some leaflets, but that weekend stayed, at least for the course of the weekend, resolutely non-political. It was just 500,000 people trying to have a good time.
Well, you had hoped to make a big profit on Woodstock, and you had printed up plenty of tickets, but the festival ended up a free festival, and this is how the announcement of the free festival sounded on stage.
This is one thing that I was going to wait a while before we talked about, but maybe we'll talk about it now so you can think about it, because we all have to make some kind of plans for ourselves. It's a free concert from now on. That doesn't mean that anything goes. What that means is we're going to put the music up here for free. Now, let's face the situation. We've had thousands and thousands of people come here today. Many, many more than we knew or even dreamt or thought would be possible. We're going to need each other to help each other to work this out, because we're taxing the systems that we have set up. We're going to be bringing the food in. But the one major thing you have to remember tonight when you go back up into the woods to go to sleep, or if you stay here, is that the man next to you is your brother. And you damn well better treat each other that way, because if they don't, then we blow the whole thing. But we've got it right there.
Well, in fact, the story of how this got to be a free concert has a lot more to do with fear than benevolence. Would you tell the story of why you were forced to make Woodstock a free festival?
Okay, it's even somewhat of a misnomer as described here.
You mean because some people had already paid? Yeah.
Well, for some people, it was not a free festival.
Yeah.
Those unfortunate few who actually bought tickets, many of whom never never were able to get to the festival because of the traffic. It certainly wasn't a free festival for John and me. It cost us roughly $3 to $4 million. But it was certainly a free festival in the legend of Woodstock, and it was definitely a free festival for the hundreds of thousands that we just heard in the background while John Morris was making his announcement from the stage.
Now, you had hoped to have, what, about 20 turnstiles that ticket holders would walk through?
We had them. We built them. The gates were up. The turnstiles were up. Ticket takers had been identified, and, in fact, their uniforms had been designed. It was really all set. Unfortunately, all of that had been constructed in Wallkill, New York, some weeks prior to the actual event. And with roughly 34 days to go, the Zoning Board of Appeals of Wallkill met one evening in response to local pressure and revoked permits that we had had for months while we finished our construction. So an entire festival construction, at great expense and effort, was out the window. We were booted from that site, and with a little more than 5 weeks to go, we had to reconstruct the entire festival site in White Lake, New York. Now, this meant that some things had to be done triple time. Overtime was very expensive, even in those days. We hired a lot more staff. We had 1,000 people working at our peak, trying to recreate the festival. A couple of days before the event was supposed to start, it really came down to, do we finish the stage, or do we try to get the stage even workable, or do we build fences and ticket gates once again? At that point, it kind of was put to John and me. Are we still in this for the money? Do we take a chance with the crowd? Do we take a chance with what may be the peaceful outcome of the festival, which we had worked so hard to maintain throughout the promotion period? We thought about it for a millisecond, I think, and said, build the stage, make sure the crowd is taken care of, make sure the systems are in place to support them, and we'll worry about taking tickets later.
My guests are John Roberts and Joel Rosenman, and they're two of the people who put on the Woodstock Festival 20 years ago. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Roberts and Joel Rosenman are my guests. 20 years ago, they began their venture capital business by investing in a rock music festival outside of Woodstock, New York. Their money came from John Roberts' inheritance. In 1974, they wrote a book about their near disasters at Woodstock. It's called Young Men with Unlimited Capital. That book has just been reissued in time for the 20th anniversary of the Woodstock Festival this August. Now, you had planned to have a lot of off-duty New York City police to come and keep the peace at the festival. At the last minute, the police reneged on the offer because the person who had made the offer got a heart attack and his replacement didn't think it was a very wise idea. But while you were still planning on using the New York City off-duty police,
yes,
what kind of deal did you have with them? Were they going to bus people for doing illegal things like smoking marijuana and dropping LSD or walking around naked?
No, they weren't. We had rather extensive interviews and rehearsals with the off-duty policemen that we selected. In fact, we had applicants, I think over 1,000 applicants for about 300 places. And we would pose questions to them, such as, if a young man with long hair comes up to you over the course of the weekend and blows marijuana smoke in your face, what is the correct reaction? If the policeman said, I'd take my nightstick and whop him one, then we would look for another candidate. If he said, I'd smile and walk away, then we probably had the right guy. What we wanted there was not a group of people to bust the crowd. We wanted people who were tolerant, who would keep the peace, who would see that people did not hurt each other, and who basically had bought into the dream and the idea of 3 days of peace and music.
What did you do for replacements?
Well, believe it or not, most of them showed up anyway. And it was really quite amusing because they didn't use their real names. They would sign in as Mickey Mouse or Pluto or Batman or something like that. And matching up Batman with the money he was owed was, as I recall, one of the more interesting tasks after the festival. So I would say of the 300 we hired, Over 250 actually showed up, and they did a fine job.
The first night of the Woodstock Festival, that Friday night, there was a terrible thunderstorm. On stage, it sounded something like this.
It looks like we're going to get a little bit of rain, so you better cover up. Hurry up. If it does, and if we should have a slight power problem, just cool it out. We'll sit here with you. We'll be okay.
Everybody get out!
And let's keep it nice and cool. All right, everybody just sit down. Wrap yourself up.
Well, while that was happening, behind the scenes, you were all worrying about mass electrocution. What had happened electrically that was the worry?
It was a nightmare. We had been... it really was... It probably was the bleakest moment of the festival for me. We were sprouting walkie-talkies from every ear at that point and dealing with a dozen problems every minute or two. And on top of it all, the phone rang. The chief electrician was calling from backstage. I asked him what the problem was. He sounded pretty shaky, actually, at the time, even for a man who was going through what he was going through. He said, with the rain and all of those hundreds of thousands of feet scuffling over the performance area, the main feeder cables supplying electricity to the stage, the musicians, the amplifiers, whatever, have been unearthed. And with additional abrasion from these sneakers and whatever and sandals, it may wear away the insulation on these cables. I'm worried with all those wet bodies packed together that we may have something approximating a... And he paused for a moment, and I couldn't believe that he was searching for the words that he came up with, but he came up with mass electrocution. And I thought to myself, this is incredible. This can't be happening. He said, what do you want me to do? Should I shut down the power to the stage? Now, we had a philosophy there at headquarters that one of the reasons that this festival was proceeding so well, in spite of the adversities that everybody there was facing, the weather, the tremendous crowds, the strain on all facilities, was that the music was so mesmerizing. It was wonderful talent, brilliant artists performing. The kids were just in love with it. The thought of shutting the power down in the darkness, in the rainstorm, struck me as an invitation to chaos. Nevertheless, the thought of a mass execution posed additional moral problems. At that point, I remember breaking a two-year moratorium on smoking. I think I lit up three or four Camels at once and stuck them in my mouth and tried to think this one through. Finally, the electrician helped me out. He said, look, I think there's a chance that in the next 20 minutes I can work a shunt from the power source to the stage that bypasses those main feeder cables, and maybe that'll solve the whole problem. I said, give it a try, and hung up. And for the next 20 minutes, John and I sat there looking at each other. I guess we were waiting, like in the movies, for the lights to dim a little bit, the way they do when they throw the switch in the electric chair chamber. And I think it probably took 100 years for those 20 minutes to pass. The phone rang, and it was the chief electrician again. He said, I did it! I did it! Everything's fine!
When Woodstock was over, there were 70 legal proceedings against you. Would you list some of them?
Sure. I think you subtracted about 10, but
we
appreciate it. They ranged from local farmers suing us for $93.38 because their cows didn't give milk for 2 weeks, and we had a lot of sympathy with that, and I think we paid that right up front. To the proprietor of Monticello Racetrack, whose patrons couldn't get in on Friday night because the road was blocked. The food concessionaire ultimately sued us because he said we did not provide enough security for him, and so on and so forth. So I think, and landholders, of course, sued us because while we had rented most of the land in the area that we could find, that was in the expectation there'd be 120,000 people there. When 500,000 showed up, they inevitably spilled over into some land we hadn't rented, And those people wanted compensation.
Did most of the people who filed against you win?
No, in fact, none of them did. We never lost a lawsuit. We willingly settled a couple of the landholder lawsuits because we felt that was right. But we didn't lose a lawsuit. We turned out, and we believed ourselves, not to be culpable for a good many of the things that we were sued for. But I think people thought we were an easy touch. We'd been spending money like water all weekend, and the word got out that there were deep pockets there, and they came after us. In fact, of course, we cleaned up everything. We made everyone whole. We spent a great deal of money restoring Max Yasgur's alfalfa field to its former pristine condition. And this was an event that was never tarnished in any way by anyone remaining unpaid.
My guests are John Roberts and Joel Rosenman, the two backers of the Woodstock Festival and authors of a book about it called Young Men with Unlimited Capital. It's amazing that you've both stayed together for the past 20 years. What are some of the... You still have your venture capital business, I take it?
Yes, we do.
What are some of the things you've funded, some of the successful projects that actually made money that you've funded over the years?
Well, we've funded a number of different venture capital projects, including some what are called mergers and acquisitions projects. None of them was as famous as Woodstock, thank goodness, and none of them worked out, fortunately, the way Woodstock did financially. Recently, we acquired a company that manufactures ribbons and gift wrapping and then sold it to management. A little while ago, we bought a chain of retail stores selling variety goods, something like hardware and farmers products to gentlemen and country farmers, and then sold that to management. We have a stake in a candy manufacturer, and we had for a while a position in a shoe company, and we've done a number of other less conventional startups, including recently our financing of a search for sunken treasure in the Turks and Caicos Islands, looking for doubloons from Spanish galleons in the 15th and 16th centuries.
We still have some screws loose, in other words.
How much money did you finally lose on Woodstock?
Well, the movie and records finally produced enough by way of royalties for us to break even around 1980. Subsequent to 1980, we have had some revenues from that, so...
Oh.
You might say that we're in a profit position, except that we have had to use those revenues to protect the various trade and service mark applications and filings that we have. There is a misconception about Woodstock that not only was it a free concert, but that Woodstock belongs to the world. In fact, not to put too fine a point on it, it belongs to us, and we've registered it as a mark. In Washington.
I thank you both very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Terry.
My guests have been John Roberts and Joel Rosenman. Their new book, Young Men with Unlimited Capital, describes how they put on the Woodstock Festival 20 years ago. The book has just been reissued by Bantam. The 20th anniversary of Woodstock is August 15th through 17th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with former boxer Jose Torres about boxing and about his new book about Mike Tyson. I hope you can join us.
Okay, people, we got a Times. Okay. On the front page, you have on the left a very big aerial photo of a huge mass of people, which are you. And it says, "Music was the magic for throngs at Woodstock Music and Art Fair. Towers near the stage hold loudspeakers. 300,000 at Folk Rock Fair camp out in the sea of mud." Dig it, dig it.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
For years, Mo Moskowitz has been busting into the middle of Morning Edition, throwing serious journalism out the window in favor of his latest scam. Coming up, we meet the man behind Mo, satirist, author, and high school English teacher Robert Kaplow. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker samples new reggae albums from Ziggy Marley and the Jamaican group Culture. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Turner and Hooch, starring Tom Hanks as the reluctant owner of a mischievous, slobbering dog. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jessica Berman. The House of Representatives is nearing final passage of a $305 billion defense spending bill for next year, and the Senate has resumed debate on its version of the measure. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
The House handed the Bush administration one defeat after another as it worked its way through the multi-billion dollar military measure. First, the House cut funding for the Strategic Defense Initiative. Then it took huge chunks out of the B-2 bomber program, followed by a blow to the MX missile. After taking money away from programs the president wants, the House turned around and insisted on funding for projects the Pentagon is ready to kill, the F-14D jet fighter and the V-22 Osprey. Representatives from the states where those planes are made were able to prevail on their colleagues to continue production. In the bill approved by the Senate Armed Services Committee, and which the Senate will be debating into next week, the administration fared far better. If the Senate generally approves of the committee bill, large discrepancies in military programs will have to be hashed out in conference committee. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
A House committee today approved a flag protection bill, but the measure, pushed by Democrats, is being dismissed by Republicans as useless for overcoming the Supreme Court ruling permitting flag burning. The GOP wants a constitutional amendment prohibiting desecration of the flag. Democrats are trying to head that off. The state of Alaska has decided not to prosecute Exxon Corporation in connection with a massive oil spill in March. Instead, Alaska's chief prosecutor says the state will defer to the federal government, which he says could impose stiffer penalties. The crippled tanker responsible for the spill in Alaska's waters, the Exxon Valdez, will most likely dock in San Diego over the weekend after a three-week delay. Lynn Weil of CalNet Public Radio reports.
Giant steel plates hanging from the hull have kept the ship from entering the shallow San Diego waters, and the U.S. Coast Guard has barred it from the harbor because of an apparent oil leak. The source is thought to be either residue from the spill in Prince William Sound or organic substances with an oily sheen. Laboratory tests have been inconclusive. For the last week, the Valdez was docked 50 miles offshore as divers cut away the seven giant steel plates. When one plate was removed on Monday, more of the oily substance seeped out. But Coast Guard officials say waves dispersed it right away. Yesterday, representatives from Exxon and the state of California agreed to strict terms for environmental safety governing the tanker's return to San Diego. The Coast Guard plans to admit it to the bay as early as Sunday morning. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil.
Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum said today he plans to introduce a measure that would require nutritional labeling on all processed foods. Stock prices today closed at their highest level since October 1987 collapse. The Dow Jones Industrials rose 22 points. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of two new reggae albums, music that's both political and danceable. One's by the group Culture, the other's by Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers. From that album, here's some of Black My Story. From education to civilization. From astrology straight to biology. Black My Story.
Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers released their last album, Conscious Party, close to 2 years ago. That record arrived at a time when reggae had faded from mass American consciousness. Reggae as an American pop subgenre had been in decline ever since the death of Ziggy's father, Bob Marley, in 1981. By the mid-80s, reggae was a cult music whose audience in this country was smaller than the market for, say, jazz, and somewhat larger than the market for, say, polkas. But Conscious Party proved to be a big surprise hit. You could ascribe it to a unique combination of reasons. Solid tunes written by Ziggy, a production job by Chris France and Tina Weymouth of Talking Heads that was as clear as most reggae records are murky. And there was, as well, the teenage Ziggy's boyish sex appeal, a factor that rarely figures in reggae, which often seems dominated by middle-aged men. Now Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers have released their follow-up to Conscious Party, called One Bright Day.
One bright day.
That's the album's title song. One Bright Day sounds like a follow-up record. Some of its melodies are intended to remind you of tunes on Conscious Party. It's a record that's not afraid to trade on its predecessor's sound, but it's also, to its credit, a further refinement of that sound. It is, for example, more overtly political. Like his father, Ziggy is a follower of Rastafarianism, and he writes songs about that religion and its political agenda. But much more so than his father, Ziggy is interested in making satisfying dance music, music that dovetails with American pop without losing its own identity. And often that takes the form of a musical groove decorated with a few simple phrases. The message is there, but it doesn't overwhelm the rhythms.
Ziggy Marley's bright pop reggae stands in contrast to a new album by the veteran Jamaican vocal group Culture. This trio has been making records for a little over a decade, and though they're not widely known here, their influence on the music has been considerable throughout the world. Culture was described by Stephen Davis and Peter Simon in their exemplary book Reggae Bloodlines as being, quote, second only to Marley and the Wailers in the extent to which the group has internationalized its audience.
Vibration, O nation.
That's They Never Love In This Time from Culture's new album, Kumbolo. Led by lead singer Joseph Hill, Culture frequently adapts American soul, gospel, and doo-wop harmonies to reggae rhythms. There's no song on this new album to match the measured ferocity of the song that first made this group famous, 2-7's Clash. That amazing 1977 song linked English punk rockers with Jamaican Rastas.
But on a song like Innocent Blood, you can still hear culture's adventurousness and wide-ranging talent.
Culture from their new album, Kumbolo. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air.
Bob, yes, it's me again, Mo Moskowitz, professional radio personality and pool maintenance consultant.
If you listen to NPR's Morning Edition, then you already know about Mo Moskowitz. He's a hyper showbiz character who barges into the program with an unrelenting series of pitches for his new programs, new formats, movies, records, and so on. The creator of the Mo Moskowitz character is my guest, Robert Kaplow. There are several other facets to Kaplow's professional life. He's the leader of a band called the Punsters that specializes in song parodies. Their work has been featured on Fresh Air. He's a high school English teacher in suburban New Jersey, and he's also the author of several novels for young adults, including a new novel called Alessandra in Love. But let's begin with how he created Mo Moskowitz and started doing sketches on Morning Edition.
I had written a song about Steven Spielberg. And it was the summer that E.T. and Poltergeist had come out, and there was, you heard all those things about this man was making $1 million a day. And I thought, here's a chance to do a topical song. So I had written this song, Steven Spielberg, Give Me Some of Your Money. And just on a whim, really, I mailed it to Morning Edition. And I got a call. And I went and I just did the interview with Bob Edwards as myself. But somewhere along the middle of the interview, it became Mo Moskowitz doing the interview. You know, the mask fell away. And
had you already created the Mo Moskowitz character?
Yeah, he was in the song.
Oh, of course, right.
Yeah, well, in fact, he was only developed because the song was too short. So I was thinking of a way to just enhance the song somehow conceptually. And I thought, well, if this guy Spielberg indeed has all this money, then he's probably besieged with these terrible, you know, no-talent desperados calling from a phone booth in Times Square by the foreign news booth there, you know, trying to get through somehow to make the connection and get their terrible project sold. So I said, okay, that'll be the bridge of the song, is you'll hear this guy, you know, putting the money in the phone booth and trying to get through.
Yeah, hello, Steven. Mo Moskowitz calling from New York. Yeah, right, I know you're a busy man, Steven. I'm a busy man myself. There's another phone booth over there. Why don't you... Excuse me, Steven, my secretary. Now, Steve, as far as I'm concerned, you are what I call a genius-type guy. And I have a script that is, to coin a phrase, sock-a-rooney. Listen to this, okay? Guy comes down from outer space. Is this great or what? Right, he's in Martha's Vineyard looking for the Raiders of the Lost Reese's Pieces. Is this great? I mean, I'm sort of a genius-type guy myself, right? All of a sudden, this shark from the Twilight Zone comes out of the... Wait, Steven, I didn't get the best part!
Eventually, what you started doing is writing sketches that you cast people from NPR into. You gave them parts. You sent them scripts.
Yes, actually, it was kind of fun in that it became a fairly hip thing in NPR to be in a Mo Moskowitz sketch. So people liked to do it, and were very agreeable about being in it. I think, you know, the show tends to be, you know, deeply serious, and I think people enjoyed. Okay, we can laugh at the show a little bit, too, because a lot of my pieces really made fun of the solemnity of public radio, and that particular rhythm that public radio has.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes. I'm reworking Morning Edition. Got a new concept for the show, Bob. Liven it up a little bit. You know, here, look, I want you to read this proposal.
The NPR Morning Zoo.
Oh, it's a completely new format for Morning Edition. Now it's a wake-up show. No more slow stuff, Bob. Everything is 80s. Fast. Supercharged. You've heard of radio that's like a bracing cup of coffee in the morning, right? Well, this is radio that's like a boiling cup of adrenaline thrown in your face.
That's an appealing image.
Oh, here, look, I got it all scripted out. Want you to hear what it's going to sound like. Let me run it down. You ready?
I think so.
Oh, now we got to wake people up, Bob. This is radio at 90 miles an hour. Now, are you ready, Bob?
Ready.
National Public Radio takes no responsibility for the following program.
Play some music!
Hi, I'm Linda Wertheimer. Come on, Bob Edwards, play some rock and roll.
Ah, ah, this is Mo.
And this is Bob. Come on, America, time to get out of bed.
All right, what's your favorite radio network?
NPR Morning Zoo!
When did you start writing fiction, fiction for teenagers?
Sometime, I had been, shortly after leaving college, I had a bunch of jobs. I'd worked on a newspaper for a while, and I had worked on Wall Street in a job I absolutely detested.
Well, doing
and,
what?
You know, putting numbers on pieces of paper. Right. I actually took my dislike of that job, and it became Two in the City, which is about this young couple who they decide, they're seniors in high school, and it starts, they decide not to go on to college as their parents want them to, but to live together in New York. And so he gets a job working in Wall Street for this this place he absolutely detests, and that became the fictional springboard for that.
The novels that you write are in the category of, quote, young adult.
Yeah. Yes.
Why do you write novels in that category as opposed to, you know, quote, adult fiction?
I don't know if I could answer that. It's just, it's the stories that at this particular point seem most urgent to me. I don't know why. I suppose maybe people that write adolescent fiction are still, in a sense, dealing with that part of their lives and still trying to understand it and coming to grips with it and maybe even reworking it, in a sense. You know, you keep reworking it until it comes out right.
Well, the main idea in your new novel is one that I'm familiar with from my adolescence, and I think a lot of our listeners will feel the same way. And it's the idea of being, like, just obsessed with someone, but they're not really any fun to be with when you're actually with them. You know, it's only when they're far away that you really...
Yeah.
Really like them. Let me ask you to read a passage from the book that's kind of about this part.
Okay, sure.
And this is written from a girl's perspective.
Yes. So you have to make an imaginative leap and say that this is a 16-year-old girl who is writing in her journal, really, for herself. Jesus, I was mixed up. Melissa kept telling me not to see him. Of course she was right. Actually, I liked him a lot more when I didn't see him. When I was home helping my mother with the ironing, I liked to think about him. My mother would be listening to some romantic Frank Sinatra song on the radio. I'd be ironing in the laundry room, listening, and suddenly I'd find myself near tears. I'd think, God, I've got a boyfriend. He leaves me notes in my locker. Meet you fourth period for the assembly, W. I sent him a copy of E.E. Cummings' poem, If Everything Happens That Can't Be Done, for Valentine's Day. It's a great love poem. Of course, I received nothing in return from him. He had to run right to New York that afternoon, so what else is new? Somehow I wouldn't have expected to receive a Valentine from him. When I actually see him, it's never as I imagined. It's never what I felt when I was ironing. It's misread signs and sparring, and I'm not looking for any more heavy-duty intensity.
I hope you don't mind me saying that at the end of this book, Alessandra does learn more about herself and how to be more independent in all of this. And I wonder if you ever feel compelled at all writing for teenagers to have a story that has a good ending, you know, where the person matures a little bit and learns some kind of lesson.
Yeah, well, I feel more impelled myself to do that than through exigencies of the marketplace mm-hmm. or anything. That I think I feel more that as a teacher, that you know, so often you have somebody who's 16 and is just, you know, is so groping for some sense of, you know, that someone else has been through her pain and her difficulty, and that she's not absolutely alone in this.
Do you ever give advice to your students? Not about their writing, but about their personal lives?
Yes. You have to learn as a... It took me a long time to learn this as a teacher to... there's a certain point where you have to back off, too, and that I think I, in my 20s, went through what a lot of teachers do in the 20s, where just the teaching year just puts you through this emotional ringer that leaves you completely spent. And, you know, you go to graduation at the end of the year and the students walk by and it's like a book of short stories walking by. You know, oh, no, you know, there's the one with the abusive father and there's the one with the medical problem and there's the one with the love affair. And, you know, you just say, I can't continue to do this job and rip myself apart like this. So you give advice and you get involved to a certain point, and then you have to back off.
How old were you when you started teaching?
23, 24, something like that.
Did you feel like you were distant enough in age from your students? Did you feel like you were capable of being an authority figure teaching high school students when you were 23 or 24?
Not on the inside, but I could play that particular role. I played Mo Moskowitz once, and I could play Mr. Kaplow if I have to. Really, I've created this. Mr. Kaplow is my best creation. It's this teacher that is completely giving and is wonderfully supportive and always has time. And I mean, it's the teacher I wish I always had. It's the parent everyone wished they always had. It's my best creation. Really.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Kaplow's new novel, Alessandra in Love, is published by J.B. Lippincott.
Just tell me, what do you really think?
To me, it's filled with empty noise and pointless, misdirected energy.
Well, I'm not sure. You know, you're right, Bob. That idea stinks. But I've got 100,000 more. Do we have any more time in this segment?
I don't think so.
Because I got a thing here in the trunk, Bob, I want to show you. Bonsai children. Just like those little orange trees, you know? They stay little forever. You have children, but they never turn into teenagers who hate you.
Save it for now.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be hearing about the vote at Smyrna, Tennessee at the Nissan plant, where, as we reported yesterday, employees were voting on whether to be represented by the United Auto Workers Union. In that vote, they decided against it. They decided against union representation. We'll also be hearing about a bill that would make flag desecration illegal. It's been voted out by the House Judiciary Committee. And news from New Jersey today. The school district in Jersey City taken over by the state. The state says that it's been abused for purposes of political patronage down through the years. And also Atlantic City, where the mayor and several other ranking officials were arrested.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last summer, Tom Hanks was charming America in the movie Big. This summer, he's co-starring with a dog, and his new movie may be one, too. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Turner and Hooch.
It would be easy to blame Tom Hanks, of course. After the success of Big, he could have made any movie he wanted to, and he chose this one. Then, too, you could blame the preposterous phalanx of screenwriters, all five of them, or the director, Roger Spottiswood, who's made good, thoughtful movies like Under Fire, and who ordinarily could be relied upon to stay away from slop like this. But the real blame for Turner and Hooch lies with the American audience. It was the American audience who adored Three Men and a Baby, who made that Disney picture the number one box office hit of 1987, and who now reap the reward. This summer's Disney crowd pleaser, One Cop and a Mutt. Turner and Hooch, which is the movie's more formal title, is about lovable Tom Hanks, a persnickety detective in a tiny California beach town, and the dog he takes under his wing after the dog's master is murdered. Is this your standard-issue cuddle pup?
What kind of dog are we talking about here?
Oh, very, very, very big, very large, very tall, very, very wide, massive, ugly.
So, no, the dog itself is not a cliché. Everything the movie does with it is, though. First of all, we get the three men and a baby scenes in which Detective Turner buys not diapers, but dog food, and puzzles over the mysteries of care and feeding. If babies wail all night, our hooch barks. And if babies emit substances bearable only to diapers and their loving changers, so dear hooch is a veritable fountain of emissions. Intestinal gas, for instance, in one endless scene. And more fun still, drool. Great slobby gouts of the stuff, which the movie shows Hooch secreting in slow motion for our delectation. Lumbering along at this level of wit, Turner and Hooch doesn't really seem to have needed all those screenwriters, but they were probably recruited for the romantic scenes between Hanks and Mare Winningham. She plays, you guessed it, a vet. And here's how their love blossoms.
Can I see you again? Maybe we can take a walk?
No.
No.
No, no, no. Well, you see, I'm starting to like you, and if we go on a walk, I'm just going to like you even more. And then one day we might even end up in love, and everything will go along fine for a while, but then one day, bang, you're going to pull your hair out, and you're going to scream, and you're going to say you never want to see me again because I drive you crazy, and I'm left shattered. Now, who needs that? Good night.
Oh, there's also a plot. It seems Hooch's owner was murdered because he knew what was going on at the old coastal fishery, and now Detective Turner is hot on the trail. And since Hooch is the only eyewitness, only Hooch can help him. It doesn't seem to have occurred to any of the writers that if all the bad guys aren't killed in the end, some of them will have to go on trial, and the government's key witness will be able to respond to questions only by slobbering once for yes, twice for no. I must admit it's charming to see a cop picture set in a town so small that when Turner commandeers a civilian vehicle, he has to yell, "Police officer, I need your car." Oh, hi, Ernie. Still, Turner and Hooch is formula movie-making of the logiest kind. The Disney people have renewed their studio's lease on life with a successful series of savvy adult pictures from Down and Out in Beverly Hills to Good Morning Vietnam, pictures that in no way hark back to the Disney legacy. But this one is an exception. Watching it, you can't help thinking you've seen it before. Only back then it starred people like Fred McMurray and Dean Jones. Back then it was called something like The Shaggy Dog. Back then, it made you laugh. And back then, after all, you were only about 9 years old.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Today's show is produced by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Verblaitis, Richard Parker, Dan Lachlan, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about boxing with Mike Tyson's biographer, Jose Torres. Torres is a former boxer himself and trained with the same man who trained Tyson. Also, Eileen Segalov takes us to the Museum of Jurassic Technology, and Stuart Brand takes us to cyberspace. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.